Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Deep and cold. Ladies and gentlemen, from London, England, just off Leicester Square, and where I've noticed this afternoon walking by on the way here, say one does walk in London sometimes, that the Olympic timed makeover of Leicester Square, which is a, yes, it's an actual square, has resulted in one change, because it had been a very subtle makeover, you know, like they do on TV, a very subtle makeover, as I say, except I did notice that they now have sold naming rights to what they call in Britain the gents' toilets. You would recognize it as the men's room, or perhaps, if you're very cute, the little boys' room. But it's the gents' toilets now have a sponsor. You know, just the name of the, I think it's a construction company, has named the gents' toilets. And you may laugh. I may have laughed. But then my next thought was, you know, I have an album to promote. And I don't want the whole toilet. Because there are parts of it that have decidedly negative connotations, but the can't take a hint urinals appeals to me as a marketing concept. So watch for that in your square. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is something I've been, I guess, one of three media outlets to be banging on this subject. The others are Fox 8 in New Orleans and TheLens.com. in New Orleans, a nonprofit journalistic enterprise. Full disclosure that I have contributed some money to. Anyway, we're apparently the only three outlets that have been banging on this subject of the post Hurricane Isaac revelations. Most of the media in the wake of Hurricane Isaac last month have been buying the spin from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Hey, it worked. Everything held. It's all right. We did a good job. Thank us. Which is very much like the spin that they used to give after every hurricane before Katrina. So they're good at it. And then very shortly afterwards, word leaked out, pun intended, that the, and I've mentioned this on this program before, the gauges in the canals whose walls collapsed in 2005 and whose walls have, for the most part, never been fixed. The gauges which tell the Army Corps of Engineers, uh-oh, the water is now at a level higher than the new low safe water level, better do something. Those gauges did not function as they were supposed to during Hurricane Isaac, a phenomenon that was referred to derisively by the one-time daily newspaper of New Orleans as, quote, wacky gauges, and which led the New York Times reporter who was embedded with the Corps overnight during Isaac to say derisively in a tweet to me, yeah, they need better gauges. Maybe, yes, he should be embedded with a family that was flooded out for a night just to, you know, broaden his perspective. Anyway, now, ladies and gentlemen, the latest.
Let us try to stem the tide.
This is from the aforementioned Lens. The reason some critical water gauges in outfall canals failed during Isaac is simple. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers didn't follow the installation instructions for the gauges.
We can help.
After the 2011 hurricane season, the Corps replaced the gauge sensors in the three outfall canals with ones that work by radar. The new sensors, which the Corps said cost $2,000 each, should be more reliable because they sit above the water, not below. But 16 of the 25 gauges in the canals and at the entrance of Bayou St. John went out at some 16 of 25 went out at some point or another or gave bad readings at the height of Hurricane Isaac, according to readings reviewed by the Lens. Isaac was the first full test of the new floodgates and pumping system installed after Katrina. Although Corps officials say the outages of the gauges didn't hinder their ability to monitor water levels in the canals, they did contribute to misinformation during the storm. Corps personnel suspect two reasons for the outages. Isaac's winds were too strong for the tall three-legged metal frames on which many of the sensors are mounted. It's a hurricane, babe. It was a Category 1. That's what they're there for. Oh, sorry. And some sensors were installed too low, leading to false readings when the water rose. They were right, says the lens, about installing them too low. The gauges in the two of the canals, 17th Street and London Avenue, appear to be lower than the manufacturer recommends in the installation manual, which is published to help you with installing the gauges properly, if you're not the Army Corps of Engineers. Matt McBride and engineers have been tracking the system, found the user manual for the sensors after the lens published its original story on the failure of the gauges. The minimum distance for the sensor is 5 feet to make sure the sensor is at least 5 feet above the highest stage that can be measured, the manual states. Well, that would mean the sensors would have to be at least 11.5 feet above the canal bed because the safe water level is 6.5 feet. In fact, they're only 8 or 9 feet. So two of the gauges in the 17th Street Canal maxed out during the storm, another maxed out before going out when the water rose to 6.5 feet because they didn't read the manual. Asked about the installation problems, Corps spokesman Ricky Boyette, I don't name him, I just read him, responded, quote, "The Corps is currently doing a forensic analysis of outfall canal sensor performance and data collected during Hurricane Isaac. Among the things we're reviewing are sensor heights, measures to ensure stability in hurricane force winds, and additional technology that will provide redundancy at key points in the canals." Meaning, we'll get back to you. No, let us try to get back to you. And still silence from the guy who runs the department that has jurisdiction over the Army Corps of Engineers, i.e. the President of the United States. Now, in a related bunch of developments about the oil, the big oil plop in the Gulf a couple years ago, oil samples from Sheen found near the Deepwater Horizon site confirm the oil is from the ill-fated Macondo well, says a federal official. There is a Sheen reported mid-September based on satellite images. It poses no risk to the sideline, according to a press release, the shoreline. But most oil that appeared during Hurricane Isaac along shores of the Gulf of Mexico has been traced to be remnants of crude that gushed from the Macondo well during the 2010 disaster, according to Area Marine Laboratories and BP itself, which now is revealed to be a British-headquartered corporation after all. After all that stuff about, we're not really a British company. Why, we have American stockholders. Laboratories from across the states affected by the hurricane and previously oil sludge from Deepwater Horizon spill said to the non-governmental organization Bellona, headquartered in Norway, that their own independent chemical analyses revealed most of the oil found along beaches in the coastal states had come from the Macondo well. One expert says the worst of the damage from the oil remains buried in sub-sand deposits and would likely be subsurface ecosystems. The damage we don't see could be far worse than the damage we're seeing, this expert says, advisor to Bellona. The subsurface ecosystem damage can damage the genetic makeup of and productivity of subsurface ecosystems. If anybody is still accepting BP's assertions that it is not an environmental disaster any longer, this is an eye-opener, he said. My eyes still hurt, so I can't open them all the way, but there you go. If you want to open them, there it is. And following up further, Tony Hayward, head of BP back then, man who said, I want my life back, was dispatched by BP to Russia after the thing. And recently caught up, New York Times caught up with him, and he's involved in independent oil company now, no longer with BP. Feels free. He's got his life back. And the great British comedian Rob Brydon voices his song next on Hello, Welcome to the Show.
have been yachting. I should have been chilling. I did the right thing, and they made me a villain. I want my life back, away from the gusher. They gave me my life back, but they sent it to Russia. Oh, Macondo, into you my career fell. Macondo, you really were the well from hell. We paid off the experts, and we shut out the newsies. Counted the damage in onesies and twosies. I want my life back, an end to the racket. All I got was this deep water horizon tour jacket. Oh, Macondo, imagined you'd leak and spill. Macondo, never alive, but so hard to kill. We cut a few corners, and we saved a few bob. Once I'm as bad as the boss of the mob. I love my children. We talk and we text. Now I've got my life back, and the book deal is next.
From London, England, home of London, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, News of the Warm, the award-winning News of the Warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Yes, we sure can. On the heels of one of the worst droughts in the United States in more than half a century, a new study raises questions about the future of one of the most integral members of the stream ecosystems throughout the Southwest, the salamander. Thank you, Vinny. The salamander. Biologists at Wake Forest University and Davidson College conducted 5 years of research that shows how salamanders and other aquatic animals react to drought, shedding light on the impact of climate change and urbanization on salamander populations. Their findings appear in the scientific journal Herpetologica. The boy threw it in the water again. Well, in the sprinkler, actually. The heat is on for the amiable amphibian, says Science Daily. Researchers studied the northern dusky salamander. Yes, they're playing the race card with salamanders, apparently, at 17 sites in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg County, North Carolina area from 2005 to 2009, which included 12 months of exceptional drought conditions. While adult salamanders had 90% survival rates from 1 month to the next, their larvae, which must be submerged in water for development and metamorphosis, just one reason why it's great to be a salamander, their larvae disappeared from an average of 30% of sites during the drought year. When water levels in the areas observed reach a 110-year low, adult salamanders migrated from stream beds to underground or high-humidity refuges at twice the rate during non-drought conditions. With climate change models predicting droughts will become longer in duration and more severe, having knowledge of animals' response strategies to extremely dry conditions is critical to their future survival, said Stephen Price, an assistant professor of stream and riparian ecology at the University of Kentucky. They have a university in Kentucky? Really? During the drought, adult salamanders demonstrated a 90% survival rate from 1 month to the next. It sounds pretty high, but at this rate, less than 1% would survive a 4-year drought under certain climate change scenarios, said Price. Salamanders play an important role in maintaining balance in forest ecosystems. They also help keep your burger warm. They feast on stream invertebrates that help regulate the nutrients derived from leaf litter and waterways. As prey for birds and mammals, their place in the food chain is an important one. Not for long. And the well-documented presence of excessive levels of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere is causing global temperatures to rise and glaciers and ice caps to melt. We know this, some of us. New research published this month in the Journal of Physics D, Applied Physics, has shown that CO2 molecules may be having a more direct impact on the ice that covers much of our planet. Researchers from MIT have shown the material strength and fracture toughness of ice decrease significantly under increasing concentrations of carbon dioxide molecules, making ice caps and glaciers more vulnerable to cracking and splitting into pieces. This was seen recently when a huge crack in the Pine Island Glacier in Antarctica spawned a glacier the size of Berlin. With an SS regiment, ice caps and glaciers cover 7% of Earth, more than Europe and North America combined. So they're number one and are responsible for reflecting 80 to 90% of the sun's light rays that enter our atmosphere and maintain Earth's temperature. They're also a natural carbon sink, capturing a large amount of CO2. If ice caps and glaciers were to continue to crack and break into pieces, their surface area that is exposed to air would be significantly increased, which could lead to accelerated melting and much reduced coverage area on the Earth. This might contribute to changes of the global climate, says lead author Marcus Bueller. They used a series of atomistic level computer simulations to analyze the dynamics of molecules to investigate the role of CO2 molecules in ice fracturing and found that CO2 exposure causes ice to break more easily, not just in material defects induced by CO2 bubbles, but rather by the fact that the strength of the hydrogen bonds, folks, we got a war on, buy some hydrogen bonds today, won't you? The chemical bonds between water molecules and an ice crystal is decreased under increasing concentrations of CO2. This is because the added CO2 competes with the water molecules connected to the ice crystal. And it goes on from there to be even less comprehensible to the naked eye. But there you go. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen,
great moments in bipartisanship.
A remarkable moment of agreement at the vice presidential debate this week between Congressman Paul Ryan and Vice President Joe Biden.
The calendar works the same every year.
It does work the same every year.
A great moment of bipartisanship, ladies and gentlemen. We'll treasure that. Tell your grandchildren. The war on terror, ladies and gentlemen, you remember that? Well, now we're what, in year 11? And the Republicans on television, on the YAC shows this morning, Sunday morning, are hammering the Obama administration for the events in Libya. Libya, oh Libya. And particularly saying that the original story on the Benghazi incident, which resulted in the assassination of four Americans, including our ambassador to Libya, the original explanation brought forward by the administration, which was that this was a result of demonstrations against that stupid trailer of a film, Innocence of Muslims, was a soft peddling of what the administration knew or should have known, which was that this was, as the administration has itself later admitted, a terrorist attack, a well-armed, well-planned terrorist attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. The Republican attack then goes on to say that the administration is doing this because they would like to pretend that, as Darrell Issa said, he said, I'm going to say something that's not Republican. This was a mission accomplished moment where the administration is trying to pretend that they've won. And yet Al-Qaeda is still active, he says, that this attack in Benghazi represents that. What he did not go on to say, what nobody goes on to say, is maybe after 11 years, the war model of fighting terrorism has been proven not to work, two wars, and if they're still active, maybe an empirical analysis would say the way the Germans and the Italians fought terrorism in the 1970s was, I don't know, maybe. Empirical, who knows. Ladies and gentlemen, anyway, the war on terror goes on. In a motion unsealed last week, the United States government proposed new ground rules for... Oh, I'll get to that in a moment. That would be the punchline. First, there's this. They're supposed to be one of the centerpieces of our counterterrorism strategy, according to the Secretary of Homeland Security. These are the DHS's 70-plus fusion centers, places where state, local, and federal law enforcement analyze and share information. The Senate's Bipartisan Committee on Investigations found no evidence that they uncovered a single terrorist threat between April 1, 2009 and April 30, 2010. During that time, the FBI discovered a subway attacker, a major killed 13 people at Fort Hood, a guy tried to blow up a Detroit-bound airplane, and somebody attempted to detonate an SUV in Times Square. The fusion centers didn't uncover any of this. DHS has praised the fusion centers' work. The Senate found fusion centers played little, if any, role in the cases. Nor, the Senate panel writes in its just-released report, according to Wired, analyzing more than 80,000 fusion center documents, could the inquiry identify a contribution such fusion center reporting made to disrupt an active terrorist plot? Unnamed DHS officials told the panel the fusion centers produce, quote, predominantly useless information and, quote, a bunch of crap, unquote. Well, that's what gives the parts of the men's room, I'm not going to sponsor, a bad name. An internal 2010 assessment, which Department of Homeland Security did not share with Congress, found that a third of all the fusion centers don't have defined procedures for sharing intelligence, which is one of the prime reasons for their existence. At least four fusion centers identified by the Department of Homeland Security do not exist, according to the Senate report. Where are those fusion centers? We lost their, they rolled under the, they're behind the couch, they rolled under the thing. Those that do are hives of incompetence, bureaucracy, mission creep. You remember him. He hangs around. And possible civil liberties abuses. Despite instituting privacy protections, the Senate report says, DHS continued to store troubling intelligence reports from fusion centers on U.S. persons, possibly in violation of the Privacy Act. A third of reviewed reports from these centers lacked, quote, any useful information on terrorism, or they possibly violated civil liberties. Other reports sat for months until their information was obsolete by the time it was published. Instead of focusing on terrorism, quote, most information from the centers was about ordinary crimes such as drug, cash, or human smuggling, according to the report. Fusion centers are only supposed to analyze and spread information, not collect it. Along the way, they scooped up items like a leaflet for the Mongols Motorcycle Club in California telling bikers to be courteous to police. Five centers the Senate studied spent their federal terrorism grant money on hidden shirt button cameras, cell phone tracking systems, and on things like dozens of flat-screen TVs and SUVs, claiming that Chevrolet Tahoes were intended to help respond to chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosive incidents. The DHS doesn't appear to care how it spends its cash. The Senate inquiry determined that Homeland Security was unable to produce a complete and accurate tally of the expense of its support. For fusion centers, its estimates range between $289 million and $1.4 billion. Nice range. DHS, therefore, doesn't even know how much money it's spent on what it calls a centerpiece of its counterterrorism strategy. But, you know, centerpieces are overrated. Look at the periphery. Also, in this struggle, let's look for a moment at the new Iraq. You remember Iraq? Fallujah, or as I called it, Fallujah, was host to one of the bloodiest battles of the Iraq War. Its residents changed the name of their city from City of Mosques to the Polluted City after the United States had two massive military campaigns there. Now, 1 month before the World Health Organization reveals its view on the legacy of those two battles, the Independent on Sunday newspaper in London reports a staggering rise in birth defects among Iraqi children conceived in the aftermath of the war. High rates of miscarriage, toxic levels of lead and mercury contamination, spiraling numbers of birth defects ranging from congenital heart defects to brain dysfunctions and malformed limbs have been recorded. Even more disturbingly, they appear to be occurring at an increasing rate in children born in Fallujah. There is compelling evidence to link the increased numbers of defects and miscarriages to military assaults, as Mosgan Savabis-Fahani, one of the lead authors of the report, and an environmental toxicologist at the University of Michigan. Similar defects have been found among children born in Basra after British troops invaded there, according to this same research. The new findings published in the Environmental Contamination and Toxicology Bulletin will bolster claims that U.S. and NATO munitions used in the conflict led to a widespread health crisis in Iraq. Why do they hate us? They are latest in a series of studies that have suggested a link between bombardment and a rise in birth defects. This prompted a World Health Organization inquiry. Their report will be out next month. The latest study found in Fallujah more than half of all babies surveyed were born with a birth defect between 2007 and 2010. Before the siege, that was 1 in 10. Prior to the turn of the millennium, fewer than 2% of babies were born with a defect. More than 45% of all pregnancies surveyed ended in miscarriage in the 2 years after the bombing, up from only 10% before. Between 2007 and 2010, 1 in 6 of all pregnancies ended in miscarriage. That'll keep the population of Iraq. The new research, which looked at the health histories of 56 families in Fallujah, also examined births in Basra. The authors linked the rising number of babies born with birth defects in the two cities to increased exposures to metals released by bombs and bullets used over the past two decades. They found that levels of lead were 5 times higher in the hair of children with birth defects than other children. Mercury levels were 6 times higher. Children with defects in Basra had 3 times more lead in their teeth than children living in non-impacted areas. The lead researcher said for the first time there's a footprint of metal in the population, compelling evidence linking the staggering increases in Iraqi birth defects to neurotoxic metal contamination. She called the epidemic a public health crisis. You are so welcome, Iraq. No need. And now, finally, in the war on terror, we're still not supposed to know what we know, even though we know it. In a motion unsealed last week, the U.S. government proposed new ground rules for classified information in the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and 4 others charged with the 9/11 attacks. The new order says the accused cannot talk about their observations and experiences of being held by the CIA, including, quote, the enhanced interrogation techniques that were applied to the accused, unquote. That is, waterboarding. The government maintains many details of the CIA's detention program are still classified despite widespread disclosures and an official acknowledgement by President Bush in 2006. Quote, due to these individuals' exposure to classified sources, methods, or activities of the United States, an order filed in April read, anything the men say, the suspects, is, quote, presumed to contain information classified as top secret, unquote. So they can't say that they were... But I can say this.
real, but it sure as heck makes me safer. And it may not yield useful intel, at least that's what they say. But it's a pleasure so rare, seeing captives gulp air. Let's go waterboarding, USA.
It's classified.
Let's go. It's not torture if I say it ain't. Those conventions are so old and quaint.
Let's go board it.
Terrorists are gonna have some fun. Keep America number one. So let's do what we say we never ever do. No way. Let's go. Like surfing, 'cause you can't get off if you want to. And it's really hard work, but for us it feels much more like play. If the tables were turned, we'd feel really burned. But let's go water.
Can't tell anybody you heard about it on the show.
Spend my nights howling at the moon. Never wake before noon. And when the sun it rises, it always rises soon. 'Cause I spend my nights howling at the moon. I never get sleep. No, but just reach. I can feel it on the ends of my fingers, taste it on the tips of my teeth. So you see why I never get sleep.
I can't get no sleep, don't know why. I can't get no sleep, don't know why. I can't get no sleep, don't know why.
Spend my nights shooting at the stars. I know it's a long shot, but it's working out so far. So I spend my nights shooting at the stars. I never get sleep. No, but just reach. And I can feel it on the ends of my fingers and taste it on the tips of my teeth. So you see.
This is the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Oh, yeah. While the sentiment, make love, make war, not war, remains a popular one, posters for a Remembrance Day, that would be November 11th, we call it, whatever we call it, for a Remembrance Day makeout party at a Calgary, Canada pub incited rage rather than warm and fuzzy feelings from Calgarians. Did you know that? Angry veterans and supporters criticized the pub's disrespectful capitalization on the holiday. The local 110 Public Tavern and Kitchen ownership team member Brian Lee insists there was no ill intent behind the advertised free event. Rather, organizers were just not thinking. They apologized. A woman in southwest France who received a telephone bill of nearly 12 quadrillion euros has had the real amount she owed waived after the company admitted its mistake. Solène Saint-Jose from Pessac outside Bordeaux said she received the huge shock when she opened the bill for about $15 billion, nearly 6,000 times France's annual economic... $15 quadrillion, nearly 6,000 times France's annual GDP. She'd requested her amount be closed after losing her job last month. Former teaching assistant said she almost had a heart attack. There were so many zeros, I couldn't even work out how much it was. The phone company, Bouygues Telecom, initially told her there was nothing they could do to amend the computer-generated statement and later offered to set up installments to pay off the bill. In the end, the company admitted the bill should have been for 117 euros only, and eventually waived it all together. They're going to end up paying her money, I bet. It also apologized for the gaffe, which it says was down to a printing error and a subsequent misunderstanding between the client and staff at their call center. The call center, of course, was on the moon. Dateline London and restaurant chain has apologized for accidentally serving alcohol to a toddler in Wales, calling it a case of human error. BBC reported 2-year-old Sonny Reese was taken to a hospital emergency room after drinking whiskey at his second birthday party at a Frankie and Benny's restaurant in Swansea. His mother said he was clearly at high level. She said she tasted the drink after noticing he was making a funny face. Frankie and Benny's says it's extremely sorry for the incident and is looking into what systems need to be put in place to ensure it does not happen again. System. It takes a system not to serve booze to a 2-year-old, ladies and gentlemen. That's where we've come to. The Sparks, Nevada Police Department has apologized to drivers for the use of an ill-advised sign that gives the perception that the department uses speed traps. Last week, a digital reader board was placed on a street advising drivers to slow down. The board read, quote, speed trap, unquote, ahead. The language was used to encourage drivers to slow down, but in hindsight was ill-advised. It's a highly traveled road, and the speed that drivers commonly travel is 15 to 20 miles an hour over the speeded limit. The police department actively patrols that area, but has never employed a speed trap tactic. The reader board has been removed. The Sparks Police Department apologizes for the perception that they would condone any type of speed trap activities by the use of the word speed trap. This week, Emory University President James Wagner officially apologized to Jewish students who were wrongfully failed or otherwise harassed under the virulently anti-Semitism tenure of former Dean Johnny Bueller. No one believed us, former dental student Perry Brickman told the New York Times. It couldn't be this one-sided story. Emory was a great university, right? So we went off with the tail between our legs. 60 years after Brickman was shocked to discover he had flunked out of dental school at Emory, he and his classmates finally won a sense of vindication. More than 400 people packed the ballroom Wednesday to hear the public apology, an attended premiere of a documentary addressing Butler, not Bueller's reign, at the now-defunct dental program. Between 1948 to 1961, 65% of Jewish students were dismissed or forced to redo coursework, according to CNN. The school's application included a question asking prospective students to identify as either Caucasian, other, or Jew. I am sorry, we are sorry, Wagner told the crowd, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Were the kids pardoned by a board at Emory? You know, an Emory? Oh, come on. Come on now. Past cases of anti-Semitism at elite universities have been reported before, notably by former Dartmouth president James Friedman, who spoke out against discrimination at Dartmouth, as well as a broader pattern of anti-Semitism in American higher education, referring to past barriers that attempted to block Jewish students and faculty from spots at Harvard, Yale, and Columbia, is all. A former British footballer has apologized for offending Muslims worldwide after describing a prayer celebration by Muslims players as eating grass. I'm sorry, but I'm not aware of every player's religion, Gary Lineker wrote on his Twitter account. Because the players in question, you know, got down on the grass and did a little genuflection in victory. Eating grass! They're eating grass! He apologized. Colombia's president Juan Manuel Santos formally apologized to the indigenous people of the Amazon this week for massacres that occurred in the early 1900s during the rubber boom. You remember that? On Latin America's Dia de la Raza, Santos acknowledged the atrocities that occurred during the rubber boom between 1912 and 1929 in the southern municipality of La Chorrera. Allegedly, more than 80,000 indigenous people were killed at the hands of the rubber company that was founded in 1912, Casa Arana. Santos signed a petition saying that on behalf of the Colombian state, which did not prevent the barbarism unleashed by the greed that generated the rubber bonanza, I ask for pardon for the deaths, for the orphans, for the victims. But enjoy the tires. And leading to our next segment, ladies and gentlemen, the BBC's director general announced two, quote, forensic and soul-searching, unquote, independent inquiries relating to the allegations of child abuse by former DJ and TV presenter Jimmy Savile. I mentioned this last week on the show. Now the New York Times has run a piece about it, belatedly, but a bit dainty. So some details here. At a hastily arranged press conference on Friday night, George Entwistle of the BBC offered a profound and heartfelt apology to victims whose number has risen to a potential 40, covered by 14 different police forces from around the country. One of the investigations will examine whether any BBC executives improperly interfered with a news program about Savile that was canceled before it was broadcast last year. At the same time, the BBC was airing two Christmas-timed tributes to Savile shortly after his death. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news from outside the bubble and more about that guy. According to the Sunday Telegraph, Savile was first investigated by police for interfering with young girls when he was a nightclub manager in Leeds as long ago as 1958. His former bodyguard told the Sunday Telegraph Savile claimed to have paid police to drop the case. It was first of at least six investigations that included an inquiry into underage sex taking place in the dressing room at Top of the Pops, a TV rock music show in the late 60s, according to the show's then producer. Police interviewed BBC staff but did not pursue the matter. An allegation in 1971 that Savile was involved with a 15-year-old dancer on Top of the Pops who then committed suicide. The girl's half-brother said Savile was interviewed as a witness, but no further action was taken. Claims that Savile was abusing patients at Stoke Mandeville Hospital in 1970. A detective at the time reported the allegations made by a nurse to his commanding officer, but was told there was not enough evidence to proceed against a celebrity of Savile's stature. Two further police investigations in the past 5 years, including one in 2007 over claims of an indecent assault at a school for girls. Savile was interviewed by police, but the case was dropped due to lack of evidence. And further evidence that there was widespread suspicions about Savile, his co-presenter on Top of the Pops, Tony Blackburn, spoke out to say it was to his internal regret that his former BBC colleague had, quote, been allowed to get away with these monstrous acts, unquote. The revelations raised serious concerns that the BBC covered up Savile's sex crimes at the time to protect the reputation of one of their biggest stars. Blackburn said of his, I'm disgusted beyond words at the vile, despicable actions of Jimmy Savile. He was never a friend. He was not a nice man. There were always rumors circulating about him. The problem at the time was that rumor was always hard to translate into fact. He was a master manipulator. Scotland Yard says the number of likely victims has reached 60. 14 separate forces investigating more than 100 complaints. The number of incidents reported have reached treble figures, making him a hugely prolific sex offender, says a helpline executive, one of the worst I've ever heard of. The government has been dragged into the scandal, says The Guardian. After it emerged, the Department of Health could be sued directly over claims that he abused patients when he was a volunteer at Broadmoor Hospital in the 70s and 80s. It is possible the government could face civil claims as it was directly responsible for the running of the high-security psychiatric hospital at that time. That's right. He abused people in a high-security psychiatric hospital. How dare you call him not a nice man? The story continues. There are rumors now that he abused people who were brain damaged. He was a volunteer for more than four decades at the hospital, had keys to its secure unit, at one point was appointed to lead a task force overseeing the management of the hospital. While telling reporters he was the voluntary assistant entertainment officer at the hospital, he'd been using his position to abuse inmates with impunity. One young female patient told a psychiatric nurse she'd been repeatedly raped by Saville under the stage in the hospital. Voluntary assistant entertainment officer during the 1980s, before he moved on to other patients. He's been linked to abuse at least five other establishments, including two other hospitals, three other hospitals. At the girls' school, he would stay in the headmistress's quarters. At another hospital, he had his own room, as well as an office. He assaulted a woman in a wheelchair. One nurse said she advised patients in her hospital to pretend they were asleep when Jimmy Savile came by, so he might not abuse them. Not to say that there's anything remotely similar about the activities of Lance Armstrong, but the pattern of a celebrity being free to pursue, in Armstrong's case, his apparent long-term doping, and in Saville's case, his thing, unbothered because of the celebrity status and because of the intimidation that they allegedly practiced against people who threatened, or in Lance Armstrong's case, did tell the truth, explains, ladies and gentlemen, why I went into show business. Now, more news from outside the bubble. Adnan Farhan Abdul Latif had been in Guantanamo Bay for nearly 11 years when he died last month, despite being recommended for release many times. Even in death, his travails aren't over. His body hasn't been sent back to his home country of Yemen. It's no longer at Gitmo. His remains are being held at an undisclosed location. They're being handled with the utmost care and respect by medical professionals and are being maintained at an appropriate facility designed to best facilitate preservation, says the Defense Department spokesman. This guy has had an autopsy conducted by the Joint Task Force at Guantanamo, and an investigation has been opened into his death, but no cause of death has been announced. He was found unconscious in his cell last month and could not be revived. He was never alleged to be a high-terror suspect, according to ProPublica. In 2010, he successfully challenged his detention in federal court, only to have the decision overturned on appeal. He was also recommended for transfer out of Guantanamo by the military several times, beginning in 2004. Eight other detainees have died at Guantanamo. Didn't the guy say he was going to close it? Well, I forget now. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this program. But also from outside the bubble, news of British defense chiefs are reportedly considering a faster military withdrawal from Afghanistan after criticism from one member of the cabinet over the existing timetable. Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne is said to be pushing for an earlier exit date. Officials now drawing up options for a bigger withdrawal next year than was originally planned, according to the Telegraph. One reason may be the increasing prevalence of the attacks upon Western soldiers by their Afghan buddies, a syndrome known as green on blue.
Green on blue, Kelly on aqua, green on blue, inside game, me on you. Not even a fatwa, which is brew. So glad you came. No one knew how this could happen. War so new. A doctrine of one. Green on blue. Is this how it ends up? Blue withdraws, spin unspun. Green on blue, face, green on blue, Afghans on Yanks, we're so through. Don't tell Petraeus, green on blue, but where's the thanks? Lost a slew of brothers and sisters, saving folks who don't want to be saved. One thing's true, we've learned our lesson. Blue gets to leave, green has to stay. Green on blue, not what was promised. Some say it's civics, some say it's math. Commies and Brits, they learned it the hard way. History has the last little laugh.
And now, ladies and gentlemen,
he's not a general,
he commands no troops,
he's not an inspector,
he peeks at no stoops,
he's an Inspector General.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
News of the Inspectors General for your listening pleasure. The Internal Revenue Service needs to spend more time hounding tax dodgers in an unexpected place. The federal government. Isn't that wild? According to a Treasury Department Inspector General. A report by Inspector General J. Russell George. Why, he's got three first names. Shows that 70 federal government agencies owed about $14 million in unpaid taxes, and there's really not much the IRS can do about it. While federal agencies are not required to pay federal income tax, they are, just like private sector employers, required to withhold and pay employment taxes, mainly Social Security and Medicare taxes, paid by their employees, as well as the agency's share of Social Security tax. In addition to the 70 agencies having 126 delinquent tax accounts worth $14 million, 18 other agencies had not filed or were delinquent in filing 39 employment tax returns, according to the Inspector General's report. And maybe a drop in the bucket, it still contributes to the dreaded tax gap. And as the Inspector General said, federal agencies should be held to the same filing and paying standards as all American taxpayers.
Yeah, right.
And efforts to refurbish the U.S. stockpile of aging W-76 nuclear warheads, they're the best, are falling behind schedule and threatening to bust the project's budget, according to an internal Department of Energy investigation. The project could have national security implications as the federal budget crunch collides with the need to upgrade the nation's aging nuclear arsenal. It's from the Department of Energy's Inspector General. Built in the late 70s and early 80s, the warheads are carried aboard U.S. missile subs. An estimated 760 of them are deployed. That number is more than any other weapon type in the arsenal. The refurbishment includes replacement of aging weapon parts, intended to extend the warhead's life for an additional 30 years. Design work was done at Los Alamos and Sandia Labs. The actual production work is being done in Texas, Missouri, and Tennessee. So there are some jobs. There have long been concerns about the project, including the weapon complex's widely publicized inability to remanufacture a mysterious material known by the codename Fog Bank. As long as 2006, the inspector... This whole show is classified. As long as 2006, the Inspector General's office raised concerns about risks the National Nuclear Security Administration would not be able to meet its ambitious schedule for refurbishing the warheads. In the years since, the problem has only gotten worse, according to the Inspector General's report. The senior official at the NNSA expressed confidence the agency could make up for lost time without going over budget, according to the IG. However, the report said officials working on the program, quote, could not provide plans detailing actions necessary to achieve the needed cost reductions.
Trust us. Just trust us.
News of the Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. An entertainment note for Los Angeles listeners, I'll be at the Grammy Museum. Yes, there is one. In LA Live in downtown Los Angeles. A week from tomorrow, Monday, October 22nd at 8 p.m. Talking and singing along with some musical friends from the album Can't Take a Hint. And speaking of which, that's the album you'll find that Rob Brydon song about Macondo on. It's for sale or something. That's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Available live and archived on the internet at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like the guys actually knowing how they're going to refurbish the nukes on budget if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. And thanks to Adrian Bodnum, Bodders. We've bonded, babe, here at Global Radio, this crazy little thing called Global Radio in London, for help with today's broadcast. This broadcast has a representation on Twitter. Join the 73,000 folks who check in with The Harry Shearer. And it's free. Also in entertainment news, I'll be joining Judith Owen and Richard Thompson at Cabaret of Souls at the Broad Theater in Santa Monica for performances later this month. Check with the Broad. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions that originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the Rubber Promise and the home of the homeless. So long from London Town.